I'm a litigator by background and commercial finance defense. So used to represent like banks, servicers, credit card companies, defending them from like consumer facing lawsuits. And a former boss of mine became the CEO of a cannabis company based out of Nevada called Wavesear.
Okay.
So he and I were having lunch, and I think he was explaining to me cannabis and then also kind of complaining about like the 12 different law firms he had on staff in 3 different states. And it was just this, not only was it just a huge cost center, but it wasn't centralized, it wasn't being managed, like none of it really made sense. And I was like, hey, it sounds like you need a big law firm. Like you need to centralize it and have someone quarterback all your legal needs. And he was like, that would be nice, except big law won't touch cannabis. And I was at a law firm called Locke Lord at the time. I think it was like an AM 50 large law firm. And so
Locke Lord was based out of...
Locke Lord is also nationwide, international.
But you were based out of...
Chicago office.
Dimitri Downing back with Meet Unshackled. I'm here with Irina, the American version, Dashevsky. How do you say that? Is that Russian?
Yeah, it is.
How do you say it in Russian?
Dashevsky? Yeah.
Okay, but
you said it perfectly.
That you need an accent or something. So she's with Greenspoon, one of the top cannabis marijuana law firms in the country. Legendary. Founded out of Colorado, right?
Actually, Florida, I think.
They're from Florida?
There's a big Florida off. There's a big Colorado office, but the firm is based in Florida.
And so we're going to introduce you to her, and she is the co-chair of the cannabis division.
Yeah.
Which is just pretty cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, and you have like 10 people, you said, working in the cannabis division?
We've got about 10 attorneys who are mostly almost full-time dedicated to cannabis.
And then, of course, you have a giant... How big is Greenspoon in general?
Greenspoon has nearly 300 attorneys nationwide.
All the states?
Almost all the states. Lots of offices. Like dozens of offices.
International as well?
I don't believe we're international. But competencies, you know, in all the practice areas.
So you guys can do everything for cannabis people from litigate to corporate transactions to
real estate to IP, all the stuff.
Yes. Applications, licensing. Yes. You guys do all that organic application stuff. You guys do a lot. Does your group do a lot of applications?
Indeed we do.
Yeah, like. I mean, I've
spent many sleepless nights. Yes.
I did a little bit of that too. Actually, I did do some application stuff. I was talking to her about how I really did not like reading and writing and researching all day. That's why I can't practice law. I prefer to be out there amongst the people, you know, talking, introducing people, meeting people and stuff. A good lawyer has to spend a lot of time behind the computer.
Law work is work. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I do a lot of things, but most of my business is deal flow and connecting people to what they're looking for in the cannabis space. You know, Meet is a trade organization. We connect a lot of people, but just kind of casually. You know, I do it like intensely, and that's kind of what I do for a living, but it's a great life. But enough about me. So how did you get into cannabis?
Happenstance, I guess. So it was about 2018. And I had come back from maternity leave, and so I had some bandwidth. I'm a litigator by background and commercial finance defense. So used to represent, like, banks, servicers, credit card companies, defending them from, like, consumer-facing lawsuits. And a former boss of mine became the CEO of a cannabis company based out of Nevada called Wavesear.
Okay.
So he and I were having lunch, and I think he was... explaining to me cannabis and then also kind of complaining about like the 12 different law firms he had on staff in 3 different states. And it was just this, not only was it just a huge cost center, but it wasn't centralized, it wasn't being managed, like none of it really made sense. And I was like, hey, it sounds like you need a big law firm. Like you need to centralize it and have someone quarterback all your legal needs. And he was like, that would be nice, except big law won't touch cannabis. And I was at a law firm called Locke Lord at the time. I think it was like an AM 50 large law firm. And so
Locke Lord was based out of?
Locke Lord is also nationwide, international.
But you were based out of?
Chicago. Chicago office. Yeah. And so I asked the firm if they'd let me pitch the client, take it on, and they did. And then I came to find out lots of attorneys across the country were helping cannabis-related businesses with their legal needs. Just weren't like talking about it. It wasn't centralized. It was kind of a one-off. And this is right about the time when Illinois passed adult use, and it did it through legislation, a really robust piece of legislation that had like actually a social equity component, just kind of a very forward-thinking way to have legalized cannabis.
Right.
Before that, states were doing it by ballot initiatives, and then there was like a weird rollout. And this was a huge piece of legislation that had a lot of
forward-thinking that they used the legislative process.
Correct.
But not forward-thinking that they had a good structure, because it's still nonsensical.
Totally, totally fair.
Fair enough.
I think it's maturing and shaking out better.
Sorry, hold on a second. This is a joke, by the way. I just realized this. I probably should say we took a bite out of the Big Apple here at the CW CB Expo. So we have that sitting over there. Sorry, I just realized
I like that you said that.
A half-bitten apple there.
Anyway.
It's a symbol.
I think forward-thinking in that it also addressed social equity, right? It was one of the...
Right.
Not only was it doing it through legislation that attempted to be well thought out.
Social equity in the form of issuing licenses to those who'd been
disproportionately impacted.
Yeah.
But also, the program...
Not social equity in regards to expungement.
It did do expungements.
Yeah.
It did do that. And it aimed to give a leg up on licensing to those who had been disproportionately impacted. The other thing it tried to do on paper is create incubator programs and incentivize existing industry operators from the medical program to sponsor and sort of assist social equity applicants.
Isn't it wonderful when the government can think that it can do all these things?
It was, yeah, it was, it didn't play out quite that way, but I think it was a really good faith effort and run at the idea. Like, again, the first of its kind.
Right.
So, because I was already in Chicago and already working in cannabis, kind of that legalization effort and then the forthcoming licensing rounds, you might have heard that a lot of the major MSOs came out of the Chicagoland area.
Yes.
And it all kind of happened at the same time. So
GTI, Cresco, a bunch
correct.
Of those guys, yes.
PharmaCann, Verano, right? So pivoted and kind of, at this point, it's 100% of my practice.
Cannabis, not MSOs.
Cannabis, not yes. MSOs.
You see, I used to be a qualified
Probably,
the verb back.
But, you know, we represent a range of clients.
Right. And so, but you do mom and pop, small manufacturers,
absolutely.
Cultivators, dispensaries,
ancillary businesses, all of it. And whether you need litigation, M&A, licensing work, IP work, whatever it might be.
Application writing, investors who want to do organic growth in different states.
That's right.
I always think that's the best way to make money if you're out there. Invest in a good legal team. Tell them to attack a state. Kentucky is a good option for this summer. Are you guys
Kentucky,
doing some work in Kentucky?
We're doing work in Kentucky. Lots of interesting plays to be made in Kentucky. Also, Minnesota's coming up.
Ohio.
I like Ohio a lot. I'm actually from Ohio. Big fan of Ohio.
Hawaii next year.
Hawaii.
Yeah, there's... Well, you.
I have not done any work in Hawaii. I'm going to admit that.
Well, there's like 8 licenses now there. There's medical. They're going through that transition, yeah. That dissertation level situation where you transition medicinal to adult use and you change or don't change supply chain and grandfather in and give certain rights and stuff. That's a fascinating economic issue that's been occurring in cannabis, as you guys know. It happens different ways in different states. And there's absolutely no right or wrong way to do that. Different ways to do that.
Different ways, yeah.
So
some better than others.
Yeah, I could talk about my history and stuff, but we don't need to. So what do you enjoy most about practicing cannabis? So you're like 6 years now, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Just cannabis.
Mostly cannabis. Again, it grew as my book of business grew.
Yeah.
I enjoy most.
And then you switched over to Green Spoon at a certain point. We didn't get to that.
Correct. In 2021, brought the most of the cannabis practice over to Green Spoon because the platform just made more sense. You're shocked to hear this, but cannabis clients are rate sensitive, right? Everyone's a little capital constrained. So
right.
Even though big law makes sense for a lot of these companies, the rates aren't, you know, really there. So I needed a platform that was more flexible on those kinds of things.
What does that mean,
in
platform that was more flexible?
So not just alternative fee arrangements, right, but also the rates that I charge. Greenspoon gives me flexibility and kind of more autonomy about how I go about that. And so we can kind of right-size things and do flat fees where that makes sense, adjust our rates where that makes sense, and kind of delayed fee structures, all sorts of things that kind of help clients out.
I have a weird question, just because I have you here. And I don't, I'm unshackled, I'm transparent. Actually, I probably should talk about that.
Well, now go for it.
No, I can't, because it's current litigation that I'm involved in. And I just realized I was going to ask you a question.
Want to ask it hypothetically?
No, because then the person that I'm adverse to would end up seeing this, and he's a piece of shit who stole something from me, and I'm involved in litigation with him, and it's okay. And eventually we're going to go to court. It's not a big deal. But I was going to ask you a question about that. I thought to myself, I probably shouldn't do that. Anyways, but he'll get his just desserts. So you guys practice in, but, you know, it's going to be a bonanza for law firms, Schedule 3. You know, it's going to be a massive bonanza because they're going to create a whole another set of regulations, executive, administrative orders at the national level, different agencies doing different things. And every single one of your clients is going to call you and say, what do we do here? And what do we do with this? What do you think about the whole Schedule 3, don't do anything at all, wait for descheduling? What? How are you guys involved in that? I mean, maybe you guys are writing the rules for the country for all I know.
So we're a member of NCR. Are you familiar with NCR?
NCR.
Yeah, the National Cannabis Roundtable.
Yes, yes. Okay. Yes. I just don't call them NCR.
Yeah, so I do lobby in D.C., and
yes.
I think NCR is really at the forefront of things like the rescheduling efforts, things like passing cannabis legislation in Congress. It's just taken so long that I think this administrative approach is what we can get right now. And
right.
And I think that there is a decent likelihood it goes all the way. And so I'm for it. I'm for any incremental reform because it's just been such a dogfight and so long that I'll take the reschedule to 3. In fact, I actually think it should be at least 3 or descheduled at some point.
Right.
So I do think that this is an important step. I think it'll really release a major pressure valve for existing industry in that the expectation is that 280 of the IRS code goes away.
Right.
So that's massive for existing industry. I don't know that it does much else. I do agree with you, though, like when something is reclassified, every agency out there has to kind of like reposition itself vis-a-vis cannabis, whether it's a Department of Transportation, whoever it is, right? So there are going to be a bunch of new rules and regs, but I don't know that it's going to do much else, right? I think the state markets will remain as they are.
Right.
And so, yeah, like with anything, there's a lot of, you know, legal work when the law changes.
What do you think about, my question is kind of related to, it seems like what Schedule 3 is what cannabis really is. But it also seems like there's a lot of substances like caffeine and alcohol that potentially should be in Schedule 3 based on the definition of Schedule 3. And I wish the concept of Schedule 3 never existed so that we could just put it all over here. You know, you kind of see what I'm saying? Like intellectually, like it is a therapeutic substance. It is a medicine. It is something that should be used responsibly. But so should caffeine. This is my drug. So should alcohol, and so should a lot of things. Maybe we should move them over here.
Well,
but it's going to get stuck here.
Does alcohol have medicinal value?
Yes.
I don't know. I think there's a lot of like back and forth as to that. But
late at night, you're stressed out. It's been a long day at work. You need to sleep. You drink a glass of wine. You sleep well at night. That was, what are you doing? You were medicating.
Oh, okay.
That
maybe.
Was
I don't,
a sleep aid.
I think, okay, so look, I think there's going to be a lot more R&D into cannabis if it's Schedule 3. And then I think that'll clarify a lot of what it is and what it isn't, what it could be.
Right.
But I mean, Schedule 3 lends itself to pharmaceuticals more than anything, right? It's a license to traffic in that Schedule 3 drug. You can engage in interstate commerce, but you have to first go through all the R&D and the trials and develop a pharmaceutical product that then is approved. And then, you know, it has to be prescribed by a doctor. And so I'm not sure whether cannabis belongs there forever, right? I don't think we know enough about it. Is it strictly medicinal? Because a lot of states are rolling out recreational markets, and I think you know.
It's interesting. Like, you know, like.
Adult use, right? Just 21 and over, use it responsibly. I'm not a user myself, but I mean, I hear tons of people, like,
right.
with sleep, whatever it might be.
So you're an extremely intelligent person, well-versed in the laws and the world as it is, all those things, as am I. And it's interesting. We're lucky to be alive right now and involved in this industry, because the more and more I think about it, this is evolving into something that has never existed before. And no one knows for sure what it's going to look like. People are always like, and even in this kind of conversation, I'm saying, what do you think it's going to look like? But it's going to be something new.
It's going to be something new. And it's not like alcohol, undefined. Right? Like alcohol didn't go through a schedule and then reschedule, right?
Yeah.
So it's already taking a totally different path.
But it's tough for investors because they don't know what to do with their money.
And because they've been patient, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's been a lot of patient capital, but it's been a decade with virtually no movement, which is why I'll take the rescheduling. It's an exciting sort of foot in the door situation that I think will hopefully be a catalyst for more reform.
And I agree with you that it's a good thing, but I'm certain it's going to get bogged down there for 15, 20, 25 years because it's going to take a legalization movement that's willing to endorse the concept that it's something other than a therapeutic medicinal substance. And that notion in and of itself is very challenging for a lot of people to get to. And so, like, it's just going to get stuck there. You know what I'm saying?
I hear you. I do. I also think I heard you say something earlier in a different interview. So forgive me if I misheard it. But I think you said you're a states' rights guy.
I am a states' rights guy.
All right. So, you know, these states are rolling out markets state after state.
Right.
Medical. And then a lot of the medicals go adult use, right? And it's not a great structure, right? You can't avail yourself of certain efficiencies if you're an MSO and whatever. But states can still do adult use. So, like, the two can coexist. And it being Schedule 3 then takes a lot of these draconian aspects of functioning in this industry away. So it's while it's imperfect, I do think the industry can thrive within that framework.
So that's interesting. So, like, you'll have this adult use situation in California, but it will no longer be in violation of federal law?
No, it'll definitely still be in violation of federal law because it's still a controlled substance that is just Schedule 3. So the penalties for that violation are different.
So the federal government will just ignore all the adult use programs?
So even now, right, they don't enforce it. So, yeah, I think the status quo will remain. With respect to the adult use programs. It's complicated.
And that's why there's lots of work for attorneys. I probably should have opened up a law firm or something.
You asked me, like, why do I like this, right? Or what I liked most about this.
Yeah.
And I think it's this. It's helping my clients navigate through the complexity. And it's ever-evolving, and there's always something new to dig your teeth into, solve. And I really enjoy figuring out how to get to endgame.
But you guys are the gold standard of one of the four law firms. I'll be fair to the other law firms that I know out there. Sure. One of the four law firms, gold standards of cannabis law. So who else is on that cannabis roundtable law firm-wise?
So actually, based out of New York, there's a law firm called Fierstein Kulik, F&K.
Okay.
Are you familiar with them?
I've heard the name. I don't know anybody from
so
there.
It's us and them, and that's it.
Okay. So they really are the gold standards. You guys are shaping things.
We're trying. Again, it's hard to move this along. I think it's taken a lot of energy. It's taken a lot of patience. It's been done on the back of a few members, right, that are just really forcing this through. So I really am excited, like, to see this reform happen.
My curiosity is, you don't have to answer this question if you want to, but my curiosity was, are you guys there on behalf of your law firm or are you there on behalf of a client? You don't have to answer that.
The law firm.
The law firm
is a member. So, yeah.
Excellent. So yeah. They ask your opinion as to, and you take the sum total of everything that you guys know.
Right.
Because there might be a client who say, hey, get in there and advocate for this because this is going to help my business structure.
The agenda is set by the organization. And so it's done. And that's why, you know, not everybody makes sense as a member.
Yeah. Right?
You kind of have to align with the overall concept of pushing for incremental reform at the federal level.
What do you think of the future of interstate commerce?
Tough question.
It is a tough question. Let me ask you a hypothetical, though, because people are trying to conduct business in the cannabis space. and you have, say, MSO, like, let's just take an example of a gentleman I talked to, Ianthus, okay, Ianthus, I talked to the CEO, Ianthus, very nice guy, he was on our podcast, Benzinga, and I said, you know, how many retails do you have? He's like, 7 states, retail, then they have manufacturing in some states, cultivation in other states, and they would prefer just to be retailers, but they also have to manufacture in all states, maybe some states, because they can just buy off the,
sure,
procure products off the supply chain that exists if there's, I mean, I think Florida is the only totally vertical state.
Florida mandates verticality.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the only one that absolutely mandates. Maybe yeah. Hawaii did until recently.
Yeah, not so familiar with Hawaii. So I'll take your word for it.
So, what do you, would you advise a client on that? Or what do you tell people that are like, you know, like a group like Ianthus who has like retail, manufacturing, cultivation? Or let's take Trulieve, for example. They have 17 states, retail, manufacturing, cultivation. Do they want to get to interstate commerce as quickly as possible so they can manufacture in one state and ship those products across the state just so that to advance the supply chain so it makes more sense from a traditional supply chain standpoint where you can cultivate, say, in California and then ship it to Florida. Do you have any familiarity with that or any thoughts on that? Because, you know, it's something that's like a big mystery behind the scenes. And maybe without, you know, disclosing any clients, obviously, if you thought this through, because they're probably asking you, maybe where do we invest our money? What do you think is going to happen? Do I build a big manufacturing center in each state? $1 million here, $1 million here, $1 million here? Or do I plan and put a $5 million manufacturing center in California? Because interstate commerce is coming soon, you know?
So
I take the fifth on that.
No,
you know,
I think I can answer without, I don't think I have to tell you about a specific client. And by the way, I don't know that there's a right answer. I think every client is thinking about different models that make sense for them. It's hard to have and be really good at all the competencies of the vertical. It's crazy expensive and it's really hard. So like in Florida to do well, it's not only that super license, but you need all the capital to ramp that up in a way that makes sense.
Right.
Some MSOs and some operators are really great at the retail experience. They have a brand that makes sense. Some are great cultivators and, in fact, aren't that great and don't have the best retail footprint. And in an ideal world, they would each right size for whatever they need. But I think if you're talking about existing operators, the cultivation centers you're talking about are not $1 million. They're 10, 15, right? They're very expensive. And if you've already built out that footprint and you've already dedicated it to investors, it's hard to say, let's just drop it, right? Let's mothball that. And because it all makes sense to come out of California. And then I think years ago, people would have told you, oh, interstate commerce, yeah, likely in a decade. Well, it's been a decade of this industry and really virtually no reform at the federal level. So I don't know that I would bank on any interstate commerce anytime soon.
Hmm.
That being said,
good answer.
You see operators divesting themselves of certain assets that don't make sense for them anymore and moving around and getting out of states and markets that don't make sense anymore. So what has shifted is the model of like, let me gobble up all the licenses, all the ops I can, right? Now it's more about fine-tuning your operations and actually trying to become profitable or having the right kind of revenue that's still attractive to investors because it's so hard to get investor dollars these days.
Sounds like you represent Curaleaf. I'm just kidding. No, they do that.
I do not, though. But yes, I can see how they came
that.
To that.
And I've watched them fine. I have no stock in Curaleaf, but they have been fine-tuning their operations.
I can see how you got to that point, right?
Yeah. No, but it's just so fascinating. And you know, you're extremely intelligent, extremely well-versed. You know the laws, you know the regulations. You're working in D.C., you're working in politics, you're working in lobbying. And, you know, I'm a CEO of an MSO or a group or a manufacturing cultivation dispensary, and I'm trying to figure out, and I don't have anyone to turn to. And maybe there isn't an answer, but they're going to be asking you, you know, to be involved in the decision-making process because ultimately it all is going to manifest itself in the form of laws and regulations, et cetera. So they need to be in close contact with their lawyer. And if you have a team at Greenspoon, you will have the best team out there to help you navigate these uncharted waters.
I got to take you everywhere I go.
Yeah, so that's it. No, but it's good to have this conversation with you. And I was trying to highlight that, trying to highlight the fact that you know these things, you know, and you have a team, you have 10 individuals, you're talking to a lot of people, you guys have a lot of history. Yeah.
It's a complex landscape to navigate.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, lately people just start thinking about, if I'm going to do M&A, why am I doing it? What's targeted about this? How do I fill my portfolio in a way that makes sense of assets and moves? So.
Yeah, it's tough. It is a complicated industry, and it's only going to remain complicated. And as I said, it's a bonanza for lawyers, but it is what it is.
Yeah, come back to the dark side.
I could promote a law firm, but I could never do what – I mean, I don't know how much time you have to spend behind the computer, but that, to me, it's like a slow death.
Most
for me.
Of my time is behind a computer, yes. I'll just be honest.
Well, you're smarter and more capable than myself.
I doubt that.
Yeah.
No, maybe we're equal.
No, definitely not. You've litigated for 10 years. I've just hung around here for the last 10 years. So thank you for joining us, and we wish you the best of luck. And, you know, you're young. You'll be here for another 20, 30 years.
Oof.
And we look forward to, you know, what happens next, you know.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate your time. This has been another episode. And reach out to Greenspoon if you need a good law firm that's going to help you navigate these uncharted waters. It's very important.
At Neurovine, we've developed a hydroponic nutrient dosing system called the Aurora. It's advanced, easy to use, and competitively priced. The Aurora can be used in both small and large-scale facilities and works great for recirculating and drain-to-waste systems. We've got clients saving 2 to 3 hours of labor every day and getting 15% increases in their yield. You can control the Aurora directly from your smartphone or computer so you can grow on vacation. Automation is the future of agriculture, and Neurovine is the future of automation.
Neurovine City, boy. Neurovine City.
Loving the system, man. Loving the system. Happy customer right here. This is a stand-up machine. This is something else.
When they're hungry, they eat. I don't have to come out here daily to look at my phone and make sure it's doing the right thing. I love it.
Having the level of precision from the peristaltic pumps, which can be down to the milliliter, is awesome. By having such resolution and precision, we can also push the envelope of growth, and that has really helped us.
I think the system is more modular than other products. It's also, I think, a better value in general. The software that you get in the cloud and the physical hardware, it's a really effective system.
Plants are growing huge. The system really gives it the full potential.
In this business, this takes the cake.
I love everything about it. I mean, hands down, I love everything about it. The results are, you know, above and beyond what I expect, you know.
It's a pleasure to be working with you, man.
Thank you.
Really appreciate
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Okay. It's a lot.